So we also laid out a full-size model of the ridge for the men to practice on. They know where every German strong point is, every machine gun, every bunker.
General Hurry, you do know the French tried for the last year to take Vimy Ridge, yes? And that we also...
I know, sir.
What exactly makes you,
Our guns will begin at dawn.
My dear wife, this may be my last letter to you. We go into action in 20 minutes. It's the biggest thing I've ever been in.
And precisely 0500, the men will move out of the tunnels, keeping precisely 300 yards behind the creeping barrage.
Dear Mother, as I looked to right and left, all I could see was Canadians.
By 5 o'clock, Vimy Ridge was ours.
And Mother, I thought, we are a nation. This is us.
Quite stirring words there spoken about the successful Canadian attack on Vimy Ridge 109 years ago on Easter Monday, the 9th of April, 1917. So welcome to another episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And as I recall this introduction to this week's podcast, it is actually Easter Monday, but it's the 6th of April this year. Easter falls at a slightly different time. And for 4 years since I started the podcast, I've been wanting to talk about the Canadian success on Vimy Ridge, but I wasn't sure how to approach it. But I think I've got it right this week, because we hear from the soldiers themselves, as we just have. That's what we like to do. And also, rather than me talking about it, I found a Canadian historian from Edmonton called Samantha McRae, and we got an interview with her. She tells the story through the eyes of the Canadians themselves. I think that's much more effective than me trying to explain it. And as you'll hear in a minute, some of the podcast is recorded from the preserved trenches at Vimy Ridge itself, the very same trenches that the Canadians, the four Canadians divisions advanced from on that cold, snowy spring morning all those years ago.
On a cold April dawn, praying, Lord, keep me strong, for the hill here to climb, for the enemy crying, for my loved ones, Lord, help me go on. Do they think we're coming in line? The secret is ours, and now I'm going over the wall at General Bing's call. And the creeping barrage I'm behind. Fire those guns, boys. Walk and don't run, boys. 100 yards. My eyes, the wounded looking up to the skies, blood where men fell, Vimy Ridge is my hell, but we're taking Hill 145. The dust clouds finally clear, the pride of a nation draws near to blood-sacred lands where the monument stands, with the thousands who died in victory.
So as I mentioned a few minutes ago, let's now go over to Vimy Ridge, where I was guiding some people a few weeks ago, and I turned the microphone on and it gives us a summary of what happened on that day the 9th of April 1917.
This is one of the most successful operations of the Great War. It's Easter Monday, the 9th of April. They've attacked across 7,000 yards, and Sir Julian Byng is the masterpiece of this, Lieutenant General. And but as you said, as Julian said, by the 12th of April, they'd secured Hill 145, and it was a defining moment for that young country of Canada. There was a Brigadier Alexander Ross. He said, in those few minutes, I witnessed the birth of a nation. No wonder would Canada be just part of the British Empire, but a nation in its own right. And you're no longer in France, we're now in Canada. This is Canadian, and it feels like Canada, doesn't it, with the trees around us. They obtained this land in 1922. The new visitor centre, was opened in 2017. And this is the it's the largest Canadian overseas memorial anywhere in the world. It actually took 11 years to build it. And it was King George VIII that unveiled it in 1936. In 1914, when the Germans got here, the French then had many attempts to take this. There's 150,000 French casualties trying to take the ridge, and there's a memorial to them at the top. And when we get up there, we'll see around the base of the memorial, it's the Canadian Memorial to the Missing. 11,000 men that are missing, from all, not just here, but from all over the Western Front, I remember. There 107 hectares. And as you said, Michael, there was 100,000 people attended the opening ceremony here in 1936.
It was huge for the day, wasn't it?
It was. And there were 6,000 veterans in amongst them. They had a competition open to architects to come up with the best design. And it's Walter Allward that came up with it. And he said he came up with the vision in a dream. And he was so determined to make sure it was right. He lived in a house up there on site for much of the time whilst it was being built. So why was it so successful? I'll walk up there while we do it. They started planning for this in November of 1916, 6 months before the attack. So, towards the end of the Battle of the Somme, they realised that they wanted to break through somewhere else.
Right.
And they chose this site. But they had to plan meticulously for it. And as I say, they started planning for this and they got here. The Canadians actually got here 6 months before, not a few weeks before. So they knew everything about this place.
They'd well had educated.
Planes up there taking photographs. They built accurate trench maps. They built a model of the battlefield. Which is there, look. You can see the boys walking around looking at it. Everyone got to see this. They practiced the attack over and over again. There was a massive bombardment began on the 20th of March, 2 weeks before the battle, using high explosive shells that exploded on contact with the ground, all with barbed wire. So it's blowing up the barbed wire. Over a million shells were fired at the Germans. This is only like 7 kilometres, whereas we fired for the Canadian area. In the Battle of the Somme the year before, we'd fired 1.5 million over 14 miles. 50,000 tonnes of ammo. The German morale was absolutely shattered. They couldn't repair the wire during the bombardment. Rations couldn't be brought up, and the shelling turned their trenches to pulp because it rained. And they couldn't get supports up, they couldn't get reserves up, they couldn't get ration parties up. They were cut off. And then just before the battle, in previous battles, they'd used this intense bombardment, which of course gave the game away. They didn't do that here. And the Canadians moved very quickly out of those tunnels, of which there was about 13 of them. This is the only one that's left. They trapped the Germans that were still underground in their tunnels and dugouts. And they didn't have to cross no man's land, of course, in so many cases, using that creeping barrage. Every Canadian knew his task. Indiscreetly, there was a private, Ronald McKinnon, of the Princess Pat's, the Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry. He wrote to his father. He could have given the game away if this letter would have been found out. He said, we've got a good bunch of boys to go over with and good artillery support. So we're bound to get our objective all right. I understand we're going up against the Prussian Guards, which is the elite of the Germans. There's 1,500 miles of underground telephone cables and 1,100 miles of overhead lines. So they've got communication right. 30,000 Canadians are with here, and they were attacking from those tunnels within 100 yards of the German trenches. The German signal centres were targets during the final phase of the bombardments. They destroyed all the German telephone lines, and the Germans didn't know this was happening. But then they had a bit of a setback. The weather was so bad on the Sunday, they had to postpone the attack for 24 hours, and it went in on Easter Monday instead of the Sunday. They blew two mines under a German trench, killed most of that garrison, 0 hours 5:30, dawn, and they were on top of the Germans before they had a chance. And the weather. It started to snow in a blizzard, and it blew up the hill into the Germans' faces. Everything was against the Germans. It was too late for the German lookouts to warn their comrades underground as to what was happening. There was a Captain McDowell. He silenced a machine gun nest. He chased the crew away. The dugout was full of Germans, and he was outnumbered. He bluffed them into thinking he got a large group of mates with him. There were two German officers, and 75 men climbed out, and they realised they'd been tricked. One grabbed a rifle, but he was shot. And McDonnell, he received the Victoria Cross for what he did on that day. So the Germans started to retreat. There were, of course, casualties. 3,600 approximately Canadians killed during the battle, and overall 10,600 casualties. But they gained 4,500 yards. Unheard of. By nightfall, the ridge was in Canadian hands. There was no counterattack, and the Germans suffered 6,500 casualties. But more importantly, they'd lost the ridge. The first army commander was a man called General Horn. He was delighted. He said that Vimy Ridge has been regarded as a position of very great strength. The Germans have considered it to be impregnable, a bit like Tietville.
Yeah.
To have carried this position with so little loss testifies to a soundness of plan, thoroughness of preparation in execution, and devotion to duty on the part of all concerned. The 9th of April will be a historic day in the annals of the British Empire. And then we got some accounts of some of the lads that were here, and this was vicious. These Canadians were brutes. For all the right reasons. There was Private Winston Pearson, 15th. He said, soon after the attack started, I was hit in the arm by a machine gun bullet. At first, it felt as I'd been kicked by a mule. A few seconds later, the pain started. It was as if I had been repeatedly jabbed with a red-hot poker. The bullet entered my left arm just below the shoulder joint. It made a very small hole where it entered, but hit the bone, breaking it into many pieces, and the bullet itself shattered, tearing a great hole in my back. Wonder he lived to tell the story. It bled plenty, but I couldn't see this, and later I found my clothes stuck to me from shoulder to foot. At the tender age of 7, that was my total contribution to the capture of Vimy Ridge. He collapsed into one of these craters, but he recovered and survived to tell the story. Private Gordon Liddell, who was a 3rd Battalion, he said the morale of the German infantry was found to be poor. No doubt this bad impression was obtained through the severity of our barrage, stunning them and rendering them stupid. We met a lone German who was unarmed and in a state of extreme hysteria from shell shock, and was getting down on his knees and putting up his hands over and over again. And someone said, shoot the son of a bitch. And somebody did. I concluded that not all the son of the bitches were in the German rank. And then we got Private Owen in the 15th Battalion. Two terrified Germans jumped up in front of me with their arms raised and their faces contorted with fear. They'd been below this artillery barrage for all that time. Kamerad, kamerad, they shouted. A friend of mine shot at one of them. The German ducked and the bullet hit the back of the trench, where his face had been a split second before. That could have been happening. These are the German trenches, just here. This could have been happening here. I had no stomach for this. One man ahead of me was involved in the most grisly bit of action. A German had come out of the trench to meet him with his bayonet. He then chickened out and was trying to surrender. Our boy would have none of it and lunged at the German again and again, who each time lowered his arms and stopped the point of the bayonet with his bare hands. He was screaming for mercy. We don't know how that story ended. He doesn't tell us. And then you mentioned that pilgrimage in 1928, the Great Pilgrimage. Ellen Fowler, she was one who came back. She'd been born in Canterbury in 1877, trained as a nurse in St Mary's Hospital in London. And at the time of the Great Pilgrimage, she was residing in Canterbury in Kent. In an article for the British Journal of Nursing, she recalled the visit here. She said, on April the 7th, we all went up to Vimy, picking up our luncheon again at the station. We walked to the ridge and Lady Haig was with us. And we sat down there for a while, afterwards going on to the Grange Tunnel, which you've just walked through, where the German and Canadian trenches met. They have now been concreted and a new road is being constructed for conveying material to building of the Great Memorial. I noticed a poor old mother toiling up the ridge and went and asked her if I should try and get her a seat in a tarabang. For it was very hot and there was about a mile to go. Also, many young people who could have walked took up the seats. I asked her if she wanted that lift. She said, I want to tread over all the path that my son last trod. And she died in 1945. On that day, 1936, that the memorial was opened, one of the veterans wrote this. He said, I saw two or three men trying to locate a particular position here. I heard a grunt of satisfaction that showed one at least to be satisfied. He began to tell me that this was the exact sap where he received his packet. So he's talking about just over there, you know, the saps that stick out from the trenches. With two others, he said he was wounded. And as he was making the remark, a second man jumped in with a shout of, Jim! And they threw their arms around each other.
Reunited.
A moment later, what I thought to be impossible happened, for a third man found the sap. And the three who were wounded together and had not heard from each other for years were reunited on the very spot that they'll never forget. It was like a miracle. And then another chap, an old sweat, he was trying to locate a bottle of rum he'd pinched and buried just before being wounded. He didn't find it.
Good luck.
He didn't find it. And just on the other side there was Grange Communication Trench, which we just walked past. And these two, it was his relative. He died here in 1916, and they were digging that tunnel that we've just been in.
Oh, yeah.
And what happened was a German shell hit the entrance to the tunnel, sucked all the air out, replaced it with carbon monoxide and killed him.
Goodness.
I didn't tell them that until they came out the tunnel, having done the tour, what you just done.
Yeah, okay.
And he's buried in a cemetery just down at the bottom of. And this thing here, we always say to the kids, what do you think this is? And they say, it's a bunker. Well done. What do you think it's used for? Machine gun, sir. No, it isn't. It's too small. It's just observation. 9 years ago, there was an anniversary, 100th anniversary commemoration at the site of the memorial on Vimy Ridge. And I watched it back recently and I found these words by a young lady very powerful.
They were young, as we are young. They served, giving freely of themselves. To them, we pledge, amid the winds of time, to carry their torch and never forget. We will remember them.
So let's now listen to the interview that I did with Samantha McRae a couple of weeks ago, and she talks very passionately about some of the individual stories of the soldiers that were there on Vimy Ridge and also what it means to the nation of Canada. Samantha talks with such passion, emotion and pride about her country. We'll get straight into it, shall we? Well, welcome to the podcast Tales from the Battlefield, Samantha. And this week we're crossing the Atlantic Ocean all the way to Alberta, you said, wasn't it? Edmonton, Alberta.
Yes.
In Canada. So I think it's the first time we crossed the channel to do this. But I'm not on my own this week when it comes to podcasting, because I believe you're a podcaster as well, Samantha. You've started quite recently.
Yes, Terry, thanks for having me. I'm very happy to be here, as it were. I'm a new podcaster, just started out in November, and I like to say that I was just pushed by the ancestors to get this thing going. So my podcast, like yours, follows mainly the World War One, the First World War battles, and the Canadians are my focus, being a Canadian myself.
And I remember when we spoke before, you telling me that you've got an ancestor that, did he die on Hill 70? Was that what you were saying?
Yes, my great-grandfather. So my paternal great-grandfather, he was a sapper, and his name was Alexander Richardson Milburn. He was not a young man. He immigrated to Canada from Scotland in 1911 and answered the call for King and Country in, I believe it was early 1916. He went off with the Canadian Expeditionary Force as a sapper for the 2nd Field Company. And he was killed in action on 15 August 1917 at Hill 70, which was the morning of the start of the battle. His remains were never found. And my grandma was about 12 years old when this occurred. So it left an imprint on the family. And like I say, his name is on the Vimy Memorial and remains not yet located, but, you know, holding out hope.
Yes, and I think Hill 70 at above the Loos battlefield is a battlefield that I've been to a few times, mainly looking at the 1915 actions. But I think that when you go to Hill 70 now, there's a memorial there to the Canadians. There's lots of information boards as well. And I think that that's something that we'll have to come back to and have another look at in more detail, isn't it, at another time?
Because
it's a battle that is overshadowed, really, by what we're going to talk about today, which is the Battle for Vimy Ridge, which was earlier that year and much bigger. And hopefully the idea is that this podcast will go out round about the time of the anniversary. How many years are we? 1917, 109 years.
109
yeah. years. So that's why we wanted to talk to you this week. I think the first thing I wanted to know is, from your point of view, what if people that have been to Vimy Ridge, they'll know that there's lots of Canadian students there year after year, very enthusiastically tell the story of the Canadians and how the four divisions came together. They take us underground into the tunnels, and it's a very rewarding exercise for everybody that goes there. And I think what comes through is the pride that Canadian people have in what happened on the 9th of April 1917, the first day of the wider battle, the Battle of Arras. But what does it mean to you and the Canadians today?
You know, we learned a lot about the First World War when I was in school at my age. You know, it was part of our curriculum, and we were sort of taught about, you know, how to have the pride. And this was the battle that really defined Canada as a young nation.
Yeah.
I mean, at that time, this country was really only about 50 years old, I think, at that point.
Yeah.
Still very much attached to, you know, the empire, the British Empire, but this was the battle that separated the Canadians from the British, the empire itself, yet still with, you know, we were a dominion. And the Canadians at this point had really developed a reputation for being, you know, shock troops and quite ruthless. And I don't want to use the word aggressive, but we knew what we were doing at this point.
I think aggressive is a good word, a good name for the Canadians, from what I've read.
Kind. Yes. But this, like you mentioned, this was the very first time that all four Canadian divisions got together and fought together shoulder to shoulder. And I mean this in the most respectful and polite and kind, friendly way, but we all know that the ridge, the French tried to take the ridge, the British tried to take the ridge, and the Canadians did it in the span of 4 days, but really pretty much one day.
Mm. And I think looking at very much, certainly something that you should be proud of forever and ever. And I think what I've read and what I understand going to the visitor centre there is that the success they had on that day was, yes, down to the bravery of individual soldiers and NCOs and junior officers, as well as the senior officers.
Yes.
But I think it was the planning that made this, and learning from the mistakes from the previous year on the Somme, all this planning and preparation, right the way down to the lowest ranked soldier, was the key to what happened on the 9th of April. Could you just give us an idea of what they went through, how they prepared for it?
Well, we know that the commander, I believe, of the 1st Division at that time was Sir Arthur Currie.
Yeah.
We were still under Julian Byng. He was the commander of the Canadian Corps. Arthur Currie was looking after the 1st Division. But, you know, Currie himself was a brilliant strategist. And Byng allowed him to really step into that role with the planning of Vimy. So for weeks and weeks, they prepared for this battle. There were behind the lines in the rear, there were, you know, they had models, you know, trenches, everything kind of set up to mimic what the Germans had on the ridge and on the other side. They used aerial observation to see where the German trenches were. They recreated that behind the lines on our side and practiced for weeks and weeks on how this attack was going to go. And it was the first time too that right down to the privates, like you said, in the NCOs, every man was given a map and treated as a thinking participant in the war. So everyone knew exactly what was going to happen, where it was going to happen. And so when the morning came, everyone kind of knew his role. I want to say it went off without a hitch. So I think that the strategic planning, you know, the fact that every man had a map and every, you know, they treated every private as a thinking human being, you know.
They're empowered, weren't they? That's the word we'd use in this day and age, is empowerment.
Yeah, and we had our wonderful, now late historian, Dr. Tim Cook. He described Vimy as the moment that the Canadian identity was forged in fire, and he would point out that the victory, it wasn't just about the artillery or the infantry. It was about the intellectual leap that the Canadians took under Arthur Currie. And I think that really made a difference into how the battle played out. And so, yeah, that's something to be very much proud of. I think it was quite progressive at that time. For you know, people like Byng to allow that type of, you know, for every man to have a map and have.
Well, they had to trust the men as well, didn't they? Which is something that perhaps the senior leaders hadn't done, and the politicians certainly hadn't done in the first 3 years of the war. Yeah. They perhaps, you know, they didn't trust the volunteer soldiers on the first day of the Somme, for example, to you know, run across no man's land and take control. It's a completely different attitude when it comes to the Canadians at Vimy, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there was a whole lot of keep your mouth shut going around.
Yeah, we know best.
And the fact that it's, you know, it went off properly was fantastic. And even just the planning of the whole thing, the use of that creeping barrage, the fact that they were all kind of prepping in the subways, the Grange subway.
Yeah.
They were all there at 0 hour and really a really impressive work of strategy for sure.
So you mentioned the Grange subway there. And that, a subway is what the British would call a tunnel. There was a 13, 14 of them that had been constructed, going back maybe a kilometre at least to where the motorway runs there now, for people that know the area. And why was that so important, those subways or tunnels then? Why did that add, why did that help the success of the day?
Well, I think, you know, it provided, first of all, it provided cover, for one thing. It provided the shelter. It provided, and with that, the men were able to kind of really focus on what they had to do. The Canadians had kind of lived underground before the attack. And so in a way, like the birth of our nation, if you want to think about it romantically, it actually happened in the dark of the Grange tunnel before they ever saw the sun. Everybody, especially, and I'm going to do a local plug here, but the 49th Battalion, which is the local Edmonton Battalion of Infantry, they were all in that Grange subway, in that tunnel. And their task was to, leapfrog the first waves and capture the Brown Line, which was the series of German trenches, including the Bethel Trench. So those tunnels played such an important role in, you know, the preparation prior to 0 hour, but even at 0 hour, it provided the cover and like a jumping off point. And I think really helped with the planning in terms of where each battalion might be positioned in order to pull this off.
I think just you talking about that, there's a couple of things that occur to me. I was thinking, as I always do from a German perspective, blimey, they've had help. They've had 2 weeks of bombardment, and it's different to the Somme because we've, again, the artillery has learned, and they're bombarding the German reserve and support areas, so the Germans can't get rations and water up to the men in their dugouts, in their trenches, and they can't get the wounded out. They can't get reinforcements up. They don't know what's going on. It's all secret. You know, on the Somme, they knew what was going to happen. They didn't. 2 weeks this went on for. And then the snowstorm is in the Germans' faces. Yes. So that's a bit of luck there for the Canadians. They've even arranged for the weather to be in their favour, I think. They've done that. And then the poor old Germans, they look up. There's no time for them to set up their machine guns like they did on the first day of the Somme. They come up, and before they know it, the Canadians are on top of them because they've come out of these tunnels. Across a short strip of no man's land, and they're right on top of them, aren't they?
it's fantastic when you think about it, the planning that took. As it's war, right? But I think it's really something to be proud of, and this was, I go back to Currie a lot because it was just his mind, you know, the mastermind of strategy. Again, it just, he was pulling off things that hadn't been tried before in battle and succeeding just about every time, you know, and Vimy is a fantastic example of that.
Very much so, yeah. And he got some experience, suddenly, because he'd been at the Second Battle of Ypres on a defensive position in 1915. But did you tell me he wasn't a professional soldier?
No. He was from Victoria, British Columbia. So, again, we have the mind of a Canadian behind all of this. I believe he was a school teacher. I think in Victoria, he had been a volunteer. And again, you have to kind of correct me on this, but he was a volunteer with the local militia. Young men were at that time, but he really didn't have, you know, field experience.
No.
And I always like to, you know, talk about Curry. He was quite an imposing guy for, you know, the early 1910s, because I think he stood about 6'3" or 6'4".
Which is very unusual, wasn't it, for 100 years ago?
Yeah.
Everyone was under 6 foot, well under it.
Oh, yeah. You know, he was probably as wide as he was tall.
He was really?
A portly guy.
Yeah.
And you look at photographs of him and his the belt around his tunic is almost up under his armpits. So, you know, he wouldn't be good on the field.
No, really. He wouldn't be very mobile. Is that what you're saying?
Not very. No, the mind. So he rose up through the ranks fairly quickly. And I think it just had to do with the ideas he had in terms of this battle strategy. And I would like to look into more of that as well. But, and he, you know, he wasn't great financially. He went through a bit of a financial scandal, and that's well known as well. There's nothing hidden about that.
No.
And after the war, he actually went on to become the dean, I believe, of McGill. It was either McGill or McMaster University. Yeah. Here in Canada.
Right.
So he went back to his educator, which I always found interesting that as Arthur Currie, I mean, Sir Arthur Currie, he was knighted by the king on July 1st, 1917. So directly because of the actions at Vimy, he won this knighthood and then went on to do amazing things with places like Hill 70, etc. And then to go through all of that, become knighted, you know, by the King of England, the King of the Empire, and then just go back to being a teacher after the war.
Yeah.
Seemed like just...
It's unusual for senior officers and generals and that, because their life is in the army. But as you said, he came from civilian life before. Yeah. So maybe he thought, that's it, I've done my job.
Yeah. And in a way, I think that is a very Canadian thing to do. A very humble, quiet...
Very much so,
thing
yeah.
to do. Not much pomp and circumstance. Just...
No.
Yeah, a very Canadian personality.
Yeah, you're a gentle nation, aren't you, until someone puts a hand grenade and a rifle in your hand?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah,
so who were these Canadian lads then that ended up at Vimy Ridge? You know, a lot of them got British ancestry or heritage, or they'd come from Britain themselves?
Yes, a lot of them did. And there's a few I would actually like to talk about.
Please do. This is what it's all about.
Yeah. And the first one I want to talk about was a man named, he was Private Huey John MacDonald, MM. So he was awarded the Military Medal at Passchendaele.
Right.
Now, Private Huey John MacDonald, I'm going to preface this whole thing. The reason I chose him is partly because he was a local guy. He was raised up in the 49th Battalion, the Edmonton Regiment, service number 812200. But Private MacDonald was also the grandfather of my closest friend.
Oh, great. Very personal then.
Yeah. Very personal. And the interesting thing, I'll just give a quick background. My friend John, he's named after his grandfather, didn't really know anything about his grandfather until last fall, when he casually mentioned to me that, oh, my grandpa was in the First World War. And I said, no, you mean your great grandpa? You know, we're not that old. No, my grandpa. And I said, what? What did he do? And he said, I don't know. All I know is he was a runner and he survived. I said, he was a runner and he survived?
Yeah, a
and
runner. As in, runner, for people that haven't come across that phrase, this is a man that's taking messages along a trench or back to a headquarters or from a headquarters up to a forward observation officer, a FOO, or up to the, not many of these got through a day, really, did they, I don't think?
No, I think most runners, well, they had the highest rate of casualty, I believe, throughout the ranks. Maybe he was an athlete. He wasn't, as far as I know. But Huey was a farmer from Dunvegan, Ontario. He moved to Edmonton as a young man. And as a runner, he would have represented like the nervous system of the battle.
Yeah.
So in an age where artillery was, it was shredding telephone wires and cutting off communications, the runner was the only way a commander would know if a trench had been taken or not with
yeah.
these messengers. And so Huey was, he was single. He did not yet have a wife. He was about 20. He was born in 1895. So interestingly, his roots were here in Canada. He wasn't an immigrant from England or Scotland. And so the morning of the attack with the 49th, as I said before, they were in the Grange subway at 0+2 hours. And their task was to leapfrog the first waves, capture the Brown Line. And so the war diary of the 49th Battalion states, at 9:35 a.m., the battalion moved forward to the Black Line and halted there for about 40 minutes. The weather was still very bad, snow and sleet falling. The ground was in a terrible condition, the mud in many places being knee deep. So that's interesting in terms of Private MacDonald, because he is running through this weather,
yeah,
through the mud that's knee deep, and we know he survived. So he's actually getting to and from, you know, A to B. He had a bit of a reputation, I guess, amongst his battalion. They said that he had these superhuman powers, was sort of the joke, because he just didn't quit. He may have been bulletproof. So he was the quintessential citizen soldier, you know.
Yeah.
Physically, he was about 5'7". He had blue eyes. He was of average build. And his peers said he had this superhuman endurance. Now back to the 49th Battalion, while he's running around and they're positioned at the Grange Tunnel, their job was mopping up. So they were clearing out the German dugouts bypassed, you know, by the first waves of the 3rd Division.
And this was a new development as well. I got to know more about this phrase mopping up. You know, it's a dreadful phrase, really, you know, because it's a phrase that we align to, you know, when we've made a mess and clearing that up. And what they mean is by that, when they've initially they would bomb a dugout using hand grenades, but quite often in previous exchanges, the Germans wouldn't be cleared out of a dugout, or they'd be hiding in some shell holes. And as soon as the infantry have gone on, they then come up and start shooting into the back of them and cause many casualties that way. So this was a crucial exercise, wasn't it? This mopping up exercise.
Yeah, and you're right. It's a really awful term when you think about what they're going in to do.
They're finishing them off, aren't they?
You know, and they're finishing them off. And then, you know, the people like the sappers and the engineers and can come in and kind of consolidate that newly captured trench. And they're doing all of that after the mopper uppers have been through. And so they're doing all of this amongst, you know, dead soldiers. Yeah,
just imagine the sights they must have seen. You know, I know they're the enemy and they're Germans and their job is to kill them. Imagine the sights they would have seen in those trenches from caused by the artillery and rifles and hand-to-hand fighting as well. And then the battle's moved on and they've come in to consolidate those trenches, haven't they?
Yeah. Yeah. And this was what the 49th was up to. I do have a couple more war diary notes from that morning. If you'd like to hear them, they're just kind of gives you an idea of what Huey MacDonald's battalion was up to. So while he's running around in this awful driving snow and the high winds, at 5:30 a.m., the war diary states, 0 hour, our artillery opened a most intense and magnificent barrage. The morning was very cold with a high wind and driving snowstorm. The battalion was in position in Grange Tunnel and its various exits. Then there's the 9:35 a.m. entry, which I've read about the mud being knee deep in many places. And then we have another entry at 11 o'clock a.m. The war diary states, the Brown Line was reached and the work of consolidation commenced. So the mopping up. A fair amount of machine gun fire was encountered from the direction of the Pimple and Enflot Wood, and some casualties were suffered. So while the 49th reached its objectives, they were pinned down by fire coming from the Pimple, you know, the highest point on the ridge.
Yeah.
And so Private MacDonald, basically, he spent the day navigating that knee-deep mud while carrying the messages back and forth. So that was his role, and he did survive the battle. He survived the war, in fact. He was demobilized in the spring of 1919. He was awarded the Military Medal for bravery at
Passchendaele. That came later on then, didn't it, Passchendaele?
That was later on, yeah. That was later that fall. In that particular battle, his citation states that for over 40, that's 40 hours, he ran without stopping, getting messages across from the evening of October 30th until, I think, the early morning of November 2nd.
November the 2nd.
48 hours.
So this is Crest Farm. This is the Crest Farm area.
Yes.
This is the Canadians That's taking right. it. And whatever he was doing for that 40 hours, he wouldn't have been running. It'd have been impossible to run. He'd have been crawling.
Yeah. He would have been crawling. Absolutely. And he did this without stopping. And in the citation, it also states when he was on the way back from having delivered a message, he would stop and help the stretcher bearers evacuate the wounded and then go back and get another message and go back again. So for 40 hours, he did this at Passchendaele. So pretty impressive guy, pretty impressive Canadian. And that's the story of Private Huey John.
So your friend whose grandfather that is, did your friend know her grandfather?
No, he passed away about 5 years before my friend was born.
Right. Yeah, that's a shame.
And so his dad, like so many others, didn't talk about what, you know, granddad had done.
Yeah.
It just wasn't talked about.
No.
But what we do know in the lasting legacy of war for Huey was that, and my friend can kind of remember his father talking about this, Huey had difficulty staying employed. He had some difficulty with alcohol, was not the longest in temperament, had a very short temper. And I think so the reason my friend's father didn't talk a lot is there weren't a lot of good memories about, you know, dad or granddad.
No.
So, but he lived until I believe he was 71 years old. He's buried here in Edmonton in one of the cemeteries in the military section.
Right.
So,
I mean, it's interesting to say that about mood. Grumpy is what they call it. And, you know, my granddad, his pictures in front of me, he was in the Royal Garrison Artillery for all 4 years of the war, and he was awarded the DCM. I knew him, you know, as a young boy. But I was terrified of him. He was extremely grumpy. And my dad told me that, you know, quite often my dad would get a beating from him if he misbehaved, which I don't think was uncommon in those days. But I think there was a lot of fear. We never understood at the time. But I do understand now why he was like that.
Yes.
You know, it's not an excuse, but it is a reason why he was like that.
I think it helps to have that understanding. Like you said, it doesn't excuse it. But, you know, it helps to be able to understand where that came from.
Definitely. You know. Yeah.
So I do have a couple of other guys we can chat about if you want at whatever point you'd like, with the feeling of, you know, we have the runner, the hero, and then we'll have the healer. So the hero of this trio is a Lance Sergeant Ellis Sifton, VC. And so Lance Sergeant Sifton was with the 18th Battalion, which was the Western Ontario Regiment, service number 53730. His role, he was an infantry leader, a section commander, and posthumously awarded the Victoria Cross, which, of course, is the British Empire's highest award for valor. Yeah. So Ellis Sifton was a 25-year-old farmer. He was from Wallacetown, Ontario, small place. He enlisted in 1914, and he was initially assigned as a battalion driver. But he wasn't really content in the rear. He famously asked to leave his safe post to, quote unquote, take a chance with the boys in the front line. So by the time he reached Vimy Ridge, he had been promoted to Lance Sergeant. And he was known for his letters home to his sisters. And in one, he wrote, quote, I hope that the courage will be mine at the right moment if I am called upon to stare death in the face.
That means he's worried. He's not worried about dying. He's worried about what people will think of him and not doing. You hear this from a lot of them, don't you? They're worried. They're more worried about what people will think of them if suddenly in the face of the enemy, they're scared.
Yeah. What would my family think? What would my sister?
What would my mate think?
So he was not happy being a driver safely tucked at the back.
He wanted to be
right up at the front.
Mm.
He wanted more. And so when we go to Vimy Ridge on the morning of April 9th, the 18th, I have to say, pardon me, I do not speak French, so please correct me when I try and sound out these words. So on the morning of April 9th, the 18th Battalion was moving toward the village of Les Tilles,
I don't know. I'm not very good at French pronunciations either. And I think people that have listened to me over the last 4 years have got used to that. So don't worry about it.
Okay, good. So while the first German line fell easily, the second line was a bit of a nightmare for Lance Sergeant Sifton. There was a hidden German machine gun nest, which had survived the initial artillery barrage. And it began sweeping the battlefield. And it pinned Sifton's company down and inflicted heavy casualties. So in a moment of pure conspicuous gallantry, Lance Sergeant Sifton, he saw the gun barrel peeking over a parapet. And without waiting for orders, he leapt up, he dashed through a gap in the wire and charged the gun emplacement single-handedly. Like crazy. Now, I do have a bit of a description of that, and I just want to give him one moment here. It's part of his citation, so I do want to read it. But he goes into the machine gun nest, and there are Germans in there, and all he's got his rifle and his bayonet. He basically goes in, he bayonets all the Germans that are hiding in there. He gets all of them down. He's victorious. And just at the moment when, you know, victory is his, a wounded German sort of sits up and points his rifle and shoots him in the head, kills him instantly.
God.
Just as his commanding officer was arriving.
And that's how he's been awarded the Victoria Cross, because if his CO hadn't turned up, no one would have ever known what had happened.
So there was a witness to his actions. But he wanted the action. He definitely got it. He's famous for what he did. And I think his actions there definitely made a difference.
And does he have a grave?
He was buried in a mass grave at Litchfield Crater Cemetery.
Right.
Near Nouvelle-Saint-Vas. Yeah. And there is, so we have a entry from the 18th Battalion's War Diary of April 9, 1917. And 5:30 a.m., it says, at 0 hour, the advance was made simultaneously with the opening up of the artillery barrage. The battalion left the jumping off trenches. Very little opposition was met with whilst capturing the first line system. An act of conspicuous gallantry performed by Sergeant E. Sifton of C Company, AMG. Machine gun was holding up his company and doing considerable damage. Sergeant Sifton single-handed attacked the gun crew and bayoneted every man, but was unhappily shot by a dying Boche, end quote. And here's a little bit more of the detail I was looking for. So after bayoneting the German crew, and he knocked the gun over, stood alone in the German trench, and then a small party of German reinforcements advanced down the trench to retake the gun, and he fought them off as well, using his rifle as a club, until his comrades could catch up. And just as his men reached him and the position was secure, that's when the wounded German soldier picked up a discarded rifle and shot him. Interesting story there.
What a man, and using that pain.
And it really kind of brings home that reputation that Canadians have as shock troops and stormtroopers.
Yeah. I mean, he's got a rifle, but he's actually using one rifle for three purposes. He's using the bayonet, the bullets, and then he's turned it around and used it as a club.
Yeah. That takes some kind of, I don't know, have the fortitude for
The fury was up, wasn't it? He was furious. All right, so we've done two. Got one more to go, did you say? Did you say you got three?
Yeah, I've got one more. Wanted to look at from a different perspective. So this is Captain David Allison Rhodes. He was with the Canadian Army Medical Corps, the CAMC, and he was attached to the 47th Battalion, which was out of Western Ontario, and his role was medical officer. So David Rhodes, he was a 26-year-old graduate from McGill University Faculty of Medicine, which McGill is in Montreal, Quebec. He left a promising practice to serve, and as a regimental medical officer, his job was not in a sterile hospital, as we know. He was in the mud and the blood of the frontline aid posts, and often just yards behind the jumping off trenches. So on April 9th, 1917, Rhodes was tasked with establishing a chain of evacuation for the 47th Battalion as they moved towards their objectives near Suchet.
Yeah.
So He was stationary in a dugout that had been converted into an advanced dressing station. So he would have been the first point of contact for hundreds of the walking wounded and the stretcher cases coming off the ridge. The 47th Battalion War Diary records the tragic loss of their doctor during the consolidation of the ridge. So this is recorded on April 10, 1917. And it says, during the afternoon, the enemy shell fire was very heavy, particularly on our support lines and communication trenches. It is with deep regret that the death of Captain D.A. Rhodes, CAMC, the medical officer of the battalion, is reported. He was killed by a shell while at his post tending to the wounded. Captain Rhodes had done magnificent work during the attack, and his loss is a very heavy one to the battalion. So, killed on April 10th by a direct hit from a heavy German shell. The psychological toll on the battalion after their MO was killed must have been huge. And I think to the men of the 47th, sometimes, and like many other battalions, that their medical officers were kind of the father figure, you know, who represented kind of like their only hope of surviving a wound, perhaps.
Well, they're giving out, apart from having leadership skills, they've got compassion as well. They're showing compassion. All medical people show compassion, even in civil time. And they're giving the men hope, aren't they, as well? Because they're calming them down when they come out of that. And they're very so close to the front line as well in an ADS. You know, we're literally talking maybe a few hundred yards at most. And so they are always in danger. But they're giving care, aren't they? They're giving immediate care. Yeah. And dressing the wounds and sussing it out. And they're giving the men hope that they're going to survive and go back to across the Atlantic to their families from a Canadian point of view. That's what his job was.
Yeah, and comfort. You know, I think he represents the heart of the battle. You know, he was one of the healers who literally stood in the mud and the blood of the ADS. And, you know, he must have talked, you know, you think about the bravery to be in this dugout at the front. Or sort of this trench, and just trying to do your job and help other people while you yourself are under attack too. And, you know, because the mud was so thick, the stretcher bearers, they would have been exhausted. The wounded men must have been backing up at his station. He actually refused to move his post further back into safety because he knew that men would bleed out before they reached him.
Yeah.
And more specifically, he was killed instantly by a 5.9-inch shell while dressing a wound. So he, you know, you think about it this way, he died with bandages in his hand, not a rifle. I have it here. He is buried at the Villis Station Cemetery. Yeah, he was a graduate of McGill's Faculty of Medicine. So he, like I said, he had left a medical practice. It says he'd left a medical practice in British Columbia to serve. Now, so which tells me, and I have not dug deeply, this is interesting. McGill, if I'm not mistaken, is Montreal's big university. Yeah. And he was attached to the 47th, which was out of Western Ontario. And yet he'd left to practice in British Columbia.
Right.
So it looks like there's some movement going on there.
Yeah, it's a long way away, isn't it? Research. Well, everywhere's a long way away in Canada. But
yeah, we are. I mean, British Columbia is on one coast and, you know, Quebec is practically on the other, just about. Yeah. So there's some movement there. And I kind of regret that I didn't look that up. I didn't really connect dots until we're talking about it right now.
That's part of the process, isn't it? That we never finish the project. We always find out more. Have you got a photograph of him?
I don't have. But I'm sure it would be easy enough to bring one up. I don't have a photograph.
Yeah,
see what you can... I do know his headstone bears the crest of the Canadian Army Medical Corps.
Yeah.
As well as the motto in Latin, which I cannot pronounce, but faithful in adversity is the...
When we find a photo, which we will at some stage, I'll laminate it, I'll take that with me, and we'll put that in front of the headstone as well.
Oh, that would be wonderful. I'm really looking forward to that. It's been an absolute my pleasure to research these guys for your podcast. And it's something I don't get to do often enough. You know, I find when I do my own podcast, it's the battle or the incident.
Yeah. Yes, the bigger picture, isn't it?
A wider scope. Yeah, the bigger picture. And it's, and I, this is, again, what I love about your podcast is you zoom right in to specific people, their families, what their lives were like prior, afterwards. So it was a real joy to be able to look into these guys. And of course, with Huey John McDonald, I knew a lot about him because, you know, and interesting, when I was first researching him back in October, what I did was I'd written a book about him for my friend John, for John's birthday.
Yep.
And for the first time in 27 years, my friend John was speechless. It was beautiful.
You managed to get a word in.
But yeah, exactly. And John didn't even have a photograph of his granddad. So of course I went scouring the internet and genealogical websites looking for a photograph of Huey, which I found. And there was one photograph. It was a portrait of him, like so many of these guys, in uniform before they went. And I mean, you punch in a name like John McDonald, World War One, you're going to get 5,000 photographs.
Yeah.
I saw this one and I thought, that's him, because
that's him.
Looks exactly like my friend.
Oh, really?
I thought, there's no doubt. Yeah. It was amazing to see a photograph. So I, you know, I regret that I haven't pulled photographs of, you know, Captain Rhodes and Lance Sergeant Sifton. That would have been a nice, but I'm sure you will.
Yeah, we can sure find them. Yeah, we'll put them on the website.
Yeah.
Well, there's two other things that we need to do. I think one is to pay tribute to Dr. Tim Cook, that neither of us met, I don't think, but he's had an influence over us and many other people as well. And Tim was a probably the leading World War One Canadian historian. He'd written many books and lectures and things. And he was going to come on the podcast, and sadly he died, didn't he, a few months ago. And
yeah,
I know that
he'd
had an influence on you as well, hadn't he?
Absolutely. Yeah, when I sort of, I had this moment about 2 years ago when it seemed like I kind of woke up and the ancestors knocked on the door, and I realized I had to do this work, you know, because for me it was our casualty identification department of the Government of Canada had contacted me thinking that they had found a set of remains that could possibly have been my great-grandfather's, and wanted to make me aware of that, and would I consent to a DNA comparison. And so of course that lit the fire for me. I knew about my great-grandfather. I knew that he had served. I'm a genealogist as well, so I had all this information. And in that moment, I realized, as at my age, that I really didn't know anything about the First World War. And I felt ashamed of that, having lost, you know, my grandma's daddy was killed in this war. And yet there was this feeling of, how can I not know? Mm. And this, like I said, this fire got lit inside me to learn everything I could. And Dr. Tim Cook was, although I never met him, he was a great influence on me, and I, you know, have purchased a number of his books. I think he wrote 19 books and several articles on World War One with the Canadian perspective. And he, you know, you can watch his lectures and interviews on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And he, all of this, not only is all of this on at the top of his head, it seems like, but he was a prolific writer, and he very much would focus on the human side of these battles. And he was just fantastic. He was the chief historian at the Canada War Museum, which I like to think of as the little sister of the Imperial War Museum in England there. And so his loss was deeply felt across, you know, historians and people like you and I.
Yeah, he did explain to me that he was ill, but I didn't realize how ill, because he didn't say, obviously. But he's left a tremendous legacy for all us historians, and now do encourage people to go and look at Tim's work on YouTube, the lectures he's done. And he was a good chap. A little bit I knew about him, and he was extremely approachable as well, which a lot of the professional historians, as we know, are not always approachable.
That's true.
But he was the complete opposite.
Yeah. And I have a couple of his quotes that I found were interesting. I'd like to quote Dr.
Yes, please
Tim
do.
If I could. And so he often notes that while Vimy wasn't the most strategic victory of the war, which is funny to say, it was probably the most famous, but definitely not the most strategic.
Okay.
And it certainly wasn't the end of the fighting. He said it became the pivotal defining moment for Canada. And Tim Cook argued that before Vimy, we, being Canada, were just sort of a collection of regions. There were Westerners, there were Ontarians, and Maritimers. But on that ridge, for the first time, Tim Cook said, Canadians from coast to coast fought as a single unified machine. And I think that really captures the essence of Vimy very well. He also said in his punching above our weight narrative, he was quoted as detailing in his work. There's a book, actually, I have it here. It's called Vimy, The Battle and the Legend. And I mean, he didn't write little books. I mean,
it's a chunky book, that one.
All his books are very chonky, yes. So in this book, he says that the British and the French had failed to take this ridge for 2 years. When the colonials, the Canadians, succeeded where the great powers had failed, it gave Canada a seat at the table of nations. We stopped being a subordinate and started being an ally.
Yeah.
And I think that's a beautiful quote, too, because I think without Vimy, Canada may not have had a seat at the table for the signing of the Treaty of Versailles.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I really think that had we not had that success as a nation at Vimy, that we wouldn't have been able to put our signature on that paper.
And of course, Canada and all the other Commonwealth countries came together again with all of the Allies in that final 100-day offensive in 1918 as well, which, again, we'll have to talk about in another podcast, won't we, the role of Canada in that as well.
Yeah, that's a whole other
one. And Vimy probably set the ball rolling for that, didn't it? Because it gave them the confidence, the identity, and their place at the table, as Tim is pointing out there.
Yes, absolutely agreed. I think confidence really had a lot to do with that. And there are a lot of battles in the 100 Days Offensive. I mean, we talk about even the Hindenburg Line, and I don't mean to brag, but I think it was the Canadians that first broke through the Hindenburg Line.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, that's quite
across
a
the canal there, and if I remember right.
Yes.
They got across that canal. Think,
yeah. Vimy being such a, you know, that was sort of an impregnable kind of ridge, the way the Hindenburg Line was impregnable in a sense. It was this legendary.
And ball on wood. Ball on wood as well.
Ball on wood too. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's lots in there. And the more I read, especially of Tim Cook's books, the more I learn and the more I go, wow. Yeah. You know, and I'm proud to be Canadian. I'm proud of the work that our military did, and proud of my great grandfather. And I mean, he more often than not was probably carrying spools of wire and boards and a shovel and a pick rather than a rifle. But, you know,
just crucial.
Absolutely crucial what those guys were doing, you know, behind, they would come in behind the barrage. And again, the creeping barrage was perfected at Vimy.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And this was an invention, I think it was called the rolling barrage previous, and it was an invention of the French under, now the commander's name has escaped me. Yeah, I think it was Nivelle.
Nivelle came
up with the idea of the rolling barrage, and I think they had tried to use it and failed. And then it was like Curry got a hold of the idea and kind of perfected it at Vimy. So
also, they'd used it, I think the Canadians had used it at Courcelette as well, for the first time in the autumn of 1916. So that was a relatively new development then. I mean, they're still using it now,
and
aren't
that's a whole other podcast, isn't it?
It is.
I have a great granduncle who fought at Courcelette and was wounded October 9th, 1916, survived. But that's a whole other.
Right, that's four. That's a whole other. We've got at least another four, I reckon. But right, before we go, what we need to do is we've touched on the fact that you're doing podcasts. Tell people where they can find your podcast. What's your podcast called, and where can people find it?
Okay, thank you. Yes, so my podcast is called Memory and Valor, and that's, I always say that's Valor with an O-U-R for our American friends out there.
Yeah.
The website is memoryandvalor.ca. The podcast itself can be found on Spotify, Apple, and Amazon Music. I believe it's also on iHeartRadio, but I don't know a lot of people who use
it. I don't know how the podcasts get onto other platforms, because we don't put them on, but someone else does.
It's the distribution, I think, through the RSS feed, and I'm still learning so much. Yeah. But yeah, Memory and Valor. And I tend to like to release an episode weekly. And it's a tall order keeping up with a schedule like that. But
well, you've got a job as well,
so
haven't
much.
You? You're working full time.
I've got a full time job, and I'm in university full time,
Yeah,
and
a family.
I don't sleep a lot, and a couple of Newfoundland puppies who are known as Private Walter and Major Martha.
Excellent.
And so when I get home every day, my Newfoundland regiment greets me at the door.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, I'm a busy woman, but this is a labor of love, as I'm sure you can understand. The podcast is a passion project.
Yes, can
and
see that.
So,
hear
again,
that in your voice.
Yeah, memory and valor. Yeah.
And can people, like, I know you're on Facebook. You've got Facebook pages.
Mm-hmm.
Are you on other social media as well?
Yes, Memory and Valor is on Facebook. It is on TikTok, believe it or not. What's the other one? Instagram.
Instagram. Yeah, I haven't mastered that one.
Yeah, and I, you know, as an older person, I'm getting pretty good at the TikTok.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, this is the way of the future, and
it
I
is.
Understand that. My kids have kind of helped me learn as much as I can. So I try and keep, so the website, I do have a LinkedIn profile that's just under my own name, and I do promote Memory and Valor and veterans causes on LinkedIn
Yeah.
as well.
Yeah.
So yes, you can check Instagram and
Right.
TikTok and Facebook and Spotify and Apple, and it's
Yeah.
all there.
It's all there, yeah.
Yeah.
Super. Well, that's been absolutely fantastic. I've learned so much more about the Canadian, having been to Vimy Ridge so many times. It will mean more to me now when I go back next week, having learned about the soldiers that you've talked about this week. Say, so I'm out there next week, and I think we're going to be visiting Vimy Ridge as part of our
Great.
tour. But as we say, this is only the beginning. We've got lots more to do in the future, I think, as these
Absolutely.
anniversaries roll round. And in particular, Hill 70, I think that in August,
Yeah.
that's going to be an important one for us to record, because
Yeah.
I know there's VC reciprocants on Hill 70 as well, the
Yes.
information boards up there. But for now, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Terry. It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It's been great to work with you.
So thank you very much for tuning in once again to the podcast. Please do rate and review wherever you download the podcast from. That really does make a difference. And thank you, obviously, to Samantha for joining me on the podcast. I learned so much, as I said there, about Vimy Ridge. Gives it a different perspective, hearing it from a Canadian point of view. And what I'd like to do this week is to celebrate the victory of the Canadians at Vimy Ridge in April of 1917, by playing a patriotic Canadian World War I song that dates from 1915. And it's simply called I Love You, Canada. And it goes like this.
There are many flags now waving over land and over sea, and though shot and shell are flying, Canada, I think of thee. It's the land I do or die for, and my heart is there always. So when I get back home once more, is there I'll end my day. To flowers and sunshine, Canada, I think of you. And my pals here in the trenches, they are heroes, staunch and true. Every soldier in our army, they have surely stood the test. And to them I talk of Canada, the land I love the best. I love you, Canada, for you mean.
and valleys, and your stately maple tree. I love all your dear people, though far away I roam. When I hear them speak of Canada, I long for home, sweet home. I love you, Canada. Valleys, and your stately maple tree.